officers, including our mobile crisis unit. It is a different way to look at the police department. It is very transparent. We are willing to make changes and trying to do our very best in some difficult circumstances. As you see in the report, they made 13 recommendations. We agreed with all of the recommendations. Many of them are in process or have already been implemented. There are a couple that require bargaining, and when the opportunity arises, we'll move forward on that. We have some things in the queue that we're working on now, such as performance review evaluations for officers, but I think the 48-hour notice is another issue that we should bring up at bargaining.
Chief, on that question, if I could, just going off of what is in the record from Dan Handelman, and this may not be the appropriate forum to have this longer discussion, but can you just explain why you believe the current language in the contract requires 48-hour notice in these circumstances?
There's certainly been some past practices that we've been engaged in for many years that I think impact bargaining, but specific to this, our detective division, when they're called to the scene of an officer involved shooting, once the scene is contained and the investigative processes have started, they are then in charge of the investigation with the district attorney's office and the medical examiner. They ask for a voluntary interview with the officer. Officers usually decline to provide that voluntary interview immediately. Again, these are emotional events, and not having gone through one myself, I can only imagine the trauma that it causes to members involved in it. Officers are then given a notice, a 48-hour notice by the Professional Standards Division, that we will interview them within 48 hours, after that 48-hour time period, for a compelled interview. So they have the opportunity to do a voluntary interview at the scene. Officers have declined to do that. Some officers have provided voluntary interviews later to detectives, but like all citizens, they have the right to decline voluntary interviews. When we ask citizens, often they will decline as well. The compelled interview is compelled, and it is, we have to protect the integrity of the criminal investigation by firewalling that compelled interview away from our detective division. So the Professional Standards Division will move forward with their processes concurrent to what the detective division is doing.
So because it's been the topic of a lot of discussion today, both by the team that issued the report and some of the testimony, I guess it's fair to ask, do you believe that a modification of the 48-hour rule would serve the interest of getting more timely, better information, and would enhance somehow the investigative process?
I think it's an issue that we should discuss with the PPA and the district attorney's office, because they have jurisdiction over these shootings as well. The issue at play, I think, for officers is that while they are willing to give that interview statement, we're not going to know all of the information. The investigators are going to have a snapshot of what occurred, but we won't have all of the evidence gathered. We won't have interviews with other witnesses to the event, maybe for hours or days after it. So there's going to be a subsequent interview with officers involved in these incidents. That may, I think there's been pretty good science around that interview process, and that when you're involved in a traumatic incident, your memory improves over time. And so if we have an interview with an officer within a few hours of the event, they may not give us all the information they have because of the trauma they've suffered going through the event. A week or 2 weeks later, as we're asking subsequent questions, because we've gathered additional evidence and we have clarifying questions for them, they're going to have a better recollection. I want to, I think, really make clear that we have to be cognizant of that, and that the officers aren't changing their testimony or fabricating new evidence. They're simply recalling it in a better light once some time has passed.
Commissioner, did you have more?
No,
Commissioner Leonard?
Thank you, Chief Reese.
And we can call up the report authors as well if you want.
No, Chief Reese is fine. I've read each of the seven synopses of the cases, but I've also been on council the entire time each one of those incidents occurred. And each one incident of each of the seven incidents has its own particular set of circumstances, its own particular set of variables that make them mostly dissimilar from one another, except for two cases. And not only in the reading of the, and I think I've talked to you about these two cases before, but not only in the reading in the synopsis, but my recollection at the time when the incidents occurred, and that is the Gorder case and the Campbell case. What struck me as similar in those cases then as now, and I think the report also calls out as well, is the issue of really radio communications, and sometimes as simple as being on the same radio channel, that is, so they're actually hearing in real time what it is that is occurring with the suspect. So in the Gorder case, officer that actually shot to know that there was a conversation and the suspect. Of course, in the Campbell case, much the same. And also, so there's this issue of really just kind of basic radio communications, broadcast out information, and then acknowledgement by the parties, the various officers, positions, shoot that they acknowledge the message, whether it's negotiations occurring or there's some important piece of information that, and then there's the issue of incident command itself. And in both of those cases, there was criticism in this report and in others as well about the incident commander themselves focusing on the responsibilities is charged with. So my question is, and from those instances now, and I'm just really speaking to those two issues, radio communication, incident command, what has occurred from these two shootings till now that's different that you think might help us avoid those kinds of circumstances in the future?
In regards to the Gorder shooting, as we did our analysis, and as OIR pointed out, it was a very thorough analysis of the event. We determined that there were command and control issues as well as a breakdown in communication. After that, we brought in an outside expert to review our special emergency reaction team and our hostage negotiating team tactics and our command and control. That outside expert made some very strong recommendations about command and control. After that, we instituted our critical incident commander. So we specifically train our commanders that are selected for this assignment in the dynamics of tactical incidents as well as best practices. They go to outside training as well, not just police bureau training. And then when we have a CERT call out or a CERT incident, those commanders arrive and take charge of the scene of the tactical incident as well as the communication team. Specific to communications, I think in any tragedy, you're probably going to look at breakdowns in communication. It is endemic in police work. Communication is a factor to everything we do. When you have tragedies, oftentimes there is a breakdown in communication. We're human. Communication is never as seamless as you would hope it would be. To that end, though, we have trained our officers and our specifically our sergeants about critical incident command and managing these events, getting people in the same situational awareness so that key information is passed to all levels of the organization that's on scene, and making sure that officers know what is expected of them, what their role is, and also what the outcome that we desire is.
So with the Campbell case then coming after Gorder and those recommendations that you just referenced being implemented, did something not happen there that
would have expected to have happened given the training that occurred, so that.
Well, again, specific to the Campbell incident, we disciplined people that were on scene because they didn't follow our training and policies.
So as a result of the recommendations that were out of order, we had a level of expectation that wasn't met.
And training specific to that.
Okay.
So I appreciate that both the report and your responsiveness to it. It's good to see in looking through the recommendations that many of you've already done or are in progress, and I appreciate that. Could you remind me what the status of the racial profiling actions are, where we are with following through on that report?
Again, that was a report that came out of Chief Sizer's office. I have read the recommendations. We are moving forward on a number of areas. We're working with the Human Relations Committee on diversity training for our officers in the next end service. I'd be happy to provide you details of that.
I think there was some expectation that a report would come back to council. Is that going to be able to happen sometime this year?
I'll have to look at the report. I don't recall specifically whether or not we were to report back to council, but I'm happy to do that.
Because I know there has been a lot of good work being done with the Human Rights Commission and the Community and Police Relations Committee. I think it would be helpful to let the community know what's happening. And then also I think the Office of Equity and Human Rights can be helpful in monitoring and making sure that things get done.
Thank you.
So I'd like to offer that. Oh, and one more thing. I just wanted to note that in collaboration with the Safer PDX project, Lisbeth Gerritsen and others, that you have instituted a policy of stepping back in situations where somebody may be armed and suicidal, but there's no immediate danger to others. And I know that in the past 6 months, or since we instituted that policy, that there have been many people saved because we didn't have some of these incidents that are so clearly outlined in this report because the police have chosen to do that. Indeed, just yesterday we had, I believe, a successful resolution of somebody who was in crisis. We will continue to work with Captain Westbrook in your office, with Dr. Gerritsen and others, to continue to find ways to make it safer and to provide alternatives to calling 911 for people in crisis. So I
appreciate your comments, because our officers, I think what goes unrecognized is that we deal with people in crisis every day, and it's overwhelming. And our officers do exceptionally good work. And when they arrive on the scene of a person in crisis, they often save a life. And last year we took about 1,100 people into protective custody that were threatening to harm themselves or someone else. And we got them help, we got them appropriate care. Our officers do remarkably well in difficult circumstances every day.
And if that's something else that I'd like to have a report back to council about, because I think we write properly look at when we've had tragedies and what we can learn from those. I think we also need to learn from what we've done right. In addition to the critical incident reviews, I would encourage you to do routine reviews of when things went well and how did they go well. What was it that made a successful resolution? Because I think we sometimes fail to stop and recognize when either officers or others have done a very good job, and we can learn from each other. Your officers are, by their nature of their work, in patrol cars by themselves, and so having a mechanism, hopefully through the new training facility, where that knowledge can be shared on an annual basis and have the discussions about, I tried this and it worked, or I tried this and it didn't work, particularly in some of these very challenging situations, I think would be really helpful.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fish. So this is the first of three reports, is that correct? And do we have a timeline or a timetable for the presentation of the next two reports yet?
We're working through and getting all of the materials for the next group of cases.
Thanks, Chief. Thanks. I'm sorry, could you come to the microphone? It's kind of, the commissioner asked an important question. Even if you don't have an actual concrete timeline, just a sense of how you're approaching it would be useful.
So there are 11 left. We I think anticipate covering six in the next report, and then the remaining five, and I think sometime in the October-November timeframe is what we're looking at for the next report.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this report. It, I would echo what, as police commissioner, I'd echo what the police chief said in terms of written in a way, and also the auditor and Mary Beth and her team. It's written in a way that is very concrete, and it will allow us to refine and continue to improve our efforts. When I took over as police commissioner and selected Chief Reese for the position that he has, it was to reinvigorate and you know, the efforts at continuous improvement, and this definitely helps us do that. So thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Okay, with that, is this a report for a vote to accept?
So moved.
It's been moved and seconded. Carl, can you please call the vote on the motion?
I'm sorry, who seconded?
I seconded it, yeah. I do that from time to time, just to keep you on your toes.
Well, thank you to the auditor for her role in bringing this report forward. Thank you to the OIR group for the report, which has been stated by others, is very clearly written. It contains a clear set of recommendations. I appreciate your testimony. I thought the other testimony we had today was enormously helpful in framing some of the key issues moving forward. And I think it was Joanne Hardesty who said that that as part of being an accountable bureau, an accountable police force, it's important that we subject ourselves to this kind of scrutiny. This, and I appreciated her comments and complimenting the process to this point to bring this forward. Of course, the real test is how we deal with the recommendations and how quickly we deal with the recommendations and how, as it was noted, how the policies translate into the training and then to the actual results on the street. But I think this has been an unusually constructive discussion about a particularly tragic subject. So thank you very much for everyone who participated in today's hearing. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, colleagues. Bye.
And not quite. He's just the beginning of this for all of us. I do want to acknowledge your good work. I appreciated the report. Very easy to read, very succinct. I appreciate the auditor's work on this, IPR's work. They've done stellar work in the last few years, really exemplary. But particularly Chief Reese, I think, has just done an outstanding job as police chief and a tough set of issues, and I think is doing outstanding job in bringing the transparency. And he's, I appreciate him even acknowledging the insular atmosphere that can exist. Just to lay that on the table by the police chief, I think is, I would guess you would find yourself refreshing in a police chief around the United States. So I feel that we're on a great road to addressing some of those really serious issues that Joanne and Reverend Hennessy addressed here today, and others, and appreciate your work in helping us get there higher.
Fritz?
Well, thank you for a very clear report, and this council has funded this independent report because we recognize the urgency of this issue, and it was good to see in particular that the timeline for investigation has been much quicker over the past couple of years than it was previously, and I pledge that it will continue to be so. We've done a lot of work on this council over the last 3.5 years to improve the independent police review system, to encourage citizens to continue to be engaged. And I thank the citizens who came today and who have continued to be engaged over the course of many years for their persistence, for their acknowledgement when we've made improvements, and for their calling out when we need to continue. So that's part of our community policing, is making sure that the citizens who are monitoring continue to have an honor place where we listen to concerns and respond to them. I'm very pleased to be working with the Police Bureau, with the Office of Equity and Human Rights, and on the Safer PDX project. It's clearly, with so many of the cases that you reviewed, having components of mental illness, it's a challenge which I I'm compelled to take care of, and will continue to do so. We've got to work well with the county, with the mental health system, with CHEERS, with Project Respond, and we have all recognized, all those components of the system have recognized that there are pieces that we can do which will take the police out of some of these difficult incidents. And I particularly recognize Elizabeth Gerritsen for her work coordinating that and helping with the new policies in the Police Bureau, and indeed the Police Bureau for funding her position and recognizing that change needed to happen. So I thank the Mayor for your leadership of the Police Bureau for funding these important steps forward, and look forward to continuing to work on it. Aye.
I need to correct. I said Dr. I said Dr. Haynes. I sat here and realized I...
Beth. Yes.
Thank you.
Whose turn is it now?
It's your turn.
Adams.
In addition to, I want to, those that I've already thanked and acknowledge, I want to thank the men and women of the Portland Police Bureau who work hard every day to not only do the job that they have signed up for, but to continuously improve, always. And we are working very hard to be the best police, local police agency in the United States, and I think we're on our way. We still have work to do, we know that. That's why we embrace this kind of outside review, continuous. It will be continuous, I hope. I also want to thank Clay Neal, who's the Mayor's Public Safety Director, for his work on this, and I look forward to implementation and your additional report. So thanks for your work. Aye. Can you please read the title for item 659? Do you want to get paid next year? You better vote on this.
Approved fiscal year 2012-13 cost of living adjustments to pay rates for non-represented classifications and elected officials, specify the effect upon employees in the classifications involved, and provide for payment.
We only have a three-hour presentation of every... Go ahead, sir.
I can do it in 3 minutes.
Go ahead. Just keep going.
All right. David Reese. I am the Assistant HR Director for the Bureau of Human Resources. I'm here today with an ordinance that proposes cost of living increases for fiscal year 2012 and 13. And this would be adjusting non-represented employees as well as elected officials. This is an emergency ordinance. Typically, we bring it as a non-emergency ordinance, but because some of the changes in the budget affected this, we're bringing it later in the time frame than we would have wanted to do, and it does need to take effect before July 1. So it's an emergency ordinance. In line with budget resources, this ordinance adjusts the compensation rates for non-represented classifications and for elected officials in two phases. The first phase, which starts July 1, 2012, in a few weeks, increases a couple of things. It increases regular non-represented employees who are not seasonal, who are in the lowest pay ranges of the non-represented ranks, pay ranges 1, 2, and 3, and who are making $45,000 or less. It increases their rates by 3.3%. It's about 100 people of the non-represented employee group. Additionally, we are moving the ranges, but not the rates, for seasonal employees. So that structure that the seasonal employees are in is moving up 3.3%, but their rates are not being adjusted by this particular ordinance. As you might recall, seasonal employees are hired for work. They are placed at a rate deemed appropriate by the Bureau. In order to hire them, and the Bureau has a certain amount of money to pay for seasonal employees, and so that whole structure is moving, but not necessarily are they getting individual increases.
Could you just explain that to me again?
Okay.
Follow that.
Seasonal employees,
right,
are not regular ongoing employees, and so unlike your budget that has certain positions, this is money that a Bureau has available to themselves. And we have a structure that they use to place seasonal employees on. And they are free to figure out where in that structure that employee fits. And so when we come through and do an adjustment to that structure, it doesn't necessarily mean that each employee is also getting an increase because they're seasonal.
But the rate is increasing.
the structure is moving, and bureaus will continue to place those seasonal employees on that range where they need to in order to have the work done within the confines of their budget.
Thank you.
The second part to the ordinance takes place a year from now, and that is the general cost of living increase of 3.3% for other non-represented employees, those that are not receiving one now due to their wages being less than $45,000 annualized. That's when the general increase will take place. And that increase will move the rates and ranges of the non-represented employees by 3.3%. So the ranges move 3.3%, and employees, unless they are over the top due to being red circled, or if they are in a seasonal classification, they're not part of that group, their rates will move as well. That's typically what happens with our COLA increase. In this case, that's being delayed until the first payroll period in June, and that effective date for that would be June 6, 2013. That's a year from today. So that's the second part of the adjustment. This ordinance also affects elected officials in the same way. So that date of June 6, 2013 would be when the elected officials, their rates would move 3.3%. The difference is that the mayor and each of the commissioners will have an option to choose not to receive that increase at that time. We'll be checking back with those offices as we get closer to that date.
I just want you to know right now, I'm not going to take mine.
Noted. We'll be checking back with the office.
Commissioner Novick, you're not
going to take mine. Yeah, exactly.
Checking back with the offices at that time.
He said he's not taking a raise either.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm not taking my raise either.
Did you a lot of good, didn't it?
Yeah, I felt good. Well, thank you for that clarification, though. So what this does is sets the rates, but for those of us who've opted out, it doesn't change anything.
If you were to opt out at that time, you would stay at the rate that you would currently be at. As you might guess, the increases, the costing of this is relatively modest during the first year. During our current fiscal year, there is no cost because these are costs for next fiscal year. For next fiscal year, the total cost, because it is a very limited impact, is about $173,000. Now, for the following fiscal year, 2013 and 2014, it would bear the impact of that full year cost. That cost for that year would be about $5 million, about $2.3 million to the general fund, and about $2.7 million to the non-general fund, because that's the full COLA impact over a year for that out year.
And that's already built into our five-year forecast.
I believe so, yes.
Correct.
Yep. Other questions?
All right. Anyone wish to testify on this matter? Carla, can you please call the vote on this emergency ordinance?
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Well, thank you for your explanation, and thank you for our non-represented employees who are making a significant contribution. As I mentioned this morning, much of this savings of over $2 million is going to help our schools and keep our teachers employed. I have not taken a raise any year that I've been here, and I appreciate that the other employees are delaying the raise until June of next year. But it is a significant sacrifice, and I appreciate our public servants who do so much for the city. Thank you. Aye.
Adams.
Aye. We're in recess till tomorrow.
Take my shovel with me.